Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. Tell me again this acronym we're going to be talking about.
Well, it's one of these from the question list we got from Nick. And it was basically, what's our thoughts on ALARP? A-L-A-R-P. And I don't think it has to do with AARP, which is Seniors Coalition or group or whatever for low rental cars or something.
Which is only relevant to our North American listeners, just for awareness.
So I mentioned the ALARP to you mostly because I had no idea what it was. It didn't ring a bell for me or bring up any memory, but then you mentioned that it had something to do with as low as reasonably possible.
Practical.
So it's P. It could be possible. Why don't we do that?
Well, everything's possible. Whether it's practicable or not is a different thing. I don't like the term. And the reason I don't like it is not because I don't like what it stands for. I think you should always try to make things as reasonably safe or reduce risk as is reasonably practicable. And then there comes a point in time where you just need to live with whatever risk is left over. So there's always risk with driving your car, for example. We as a society have said, you know what, as long as you pass a driver's license, as long as you don't, you know, drink alcohol beforehand, as long as you obey the speed limits, all those sorts of things, that reduces the risk to a whatever you deem satisfactory. Mm-hmm. I'm down with that sort of philosophy more broadly.
Well, it wasn't, but it varies, right? I'm thinking of there's MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, that really reinforced a lot more penalties and a lot more stringent enforcement of drunk driving, at least in the U.S. Whereas prior to that, it was happy hour at work and people would drive home drunk. It was just kind of, yeah, whatever. And people died. Lots and lots of people died. And finally, a private organization said enough and got more attention to it and changed it. So what was practical changed. We didn't used to have seatbelts in cars.
No.
They were too expensive to install. Nobody would wear them. And then it became mandated. And then what became practical changed. Is that your source of issue with this acronym or this thought process? This concept?
No. I think what society deems as practicable or satisfactory or acceptable changes over time, and I think that's something we shouldn't fight. It wasn't that we all look in this history of humankind, I should say, where we're now tackling climate change, and in the past, no one really cared about how much pollution we're spewing into the atmosphere, money, because people weren't really aware of how bad it was. And now we're becoming more and more aware of it. And so what is acceptable is now changing. And I don't think we should ever run away from that reality. That means we're evolving as a society. But my issue with the term as low as reasonably practicable is that it sets up this binary, are we there yet, yes or no question. Mm-hmm. And when we come to actually making risk management or doing risk management or conducting risk analyses, I would argue that it just becomes this sort of compliance driven, what is reasonably practicable or not. And especially if this is the risk management activity you're doing after preliminary design or first run of manufacturing, it can often devolve into a simple butt covering exercise where we say, look, we've got a piece of paper where the piece of paper said that or shows that we thought about this, we thought about reducing the risk as low as reasonably practicable. And if anything else happens, then that's just one of those black swan events or scenarios we couldn't possibly predict. Mm-hmm. But we have done our due diligence. It becomes – I don't like how tied it is to the perception of due diligence.
Yeah. Well, I ran into a situation where a product was introduced and if lightning – it was a gas line, a new – not an iron pipe gas line, but a flexible corrugated, I think it was aluminum or something like that. It was coated. And if a lightning struck nearby, like within 100 yards, it was very likely that this stuff would conduct it, the energy, and get a pinhole in it. It would puncture a hole into it. And then you put a gas under pressure with an immediate electric spark that ignites it. And that's not a good thing to have inside a house. And so as low as reasonably practical was guarded on the idea that, well, it's installed, it's used in Japan, it's never had an issue, blah, blah, blah. And you can't defend against lightning strikes. And they kind of wave. And then once they started having houses burned down, they said, well, it was bad insulation, or they didn't read the instruction manuals, or, you know, if you really think it's a risk in your area, you need basically build a Faraday cage around your house so that it dissipates all the energy, does all this kind of stuff. And it went on and on and on, but it was, and I remember a chemical engineer I knew that was an expert witness that said he was like aghast that anybody would bring a new product to market in the U.S. It was just because of the legal liability type stuff that occurs. And the idea is that, yes, there is always risk. Yet when you don't have to wait for society or the courts to tell you to fix things. That's the part I have a hard problem with.
Right.
That, you know, if there's an issue, I like Tylenol got tampered with, and somebody tampered a couple of bottles. They pulled every bottle off the shelves and, you know, put on these little safety seals, which are a pain to open up and all this stuff. It was the classic how to respond to an issue like that. It's just, they did it right. They said, we're not going to wait for a second one to occur. We're not going to ignore it. We're not going to do anything else. We're just going to say, all right, this has got to be safe because you have to trust our product.
Yeah.
And deal with it. But hiding behind, and I had this with a case where it was a replacement windows for a home. So if you wanted to upgrade your windows to double pane or whatever, and you install these windows, and after two seasons, they'd start leaking because the joinery they used would not accommodate any motion whatsoever. And you're building these into wood frame buildings that are facing the sun. It's just, they're going to move. But their defense was, well, it met the standard. Well, the standard is you spray a hose at it for 30 seconds when it's freshly installed.
Right.
It's never moved. It's like, no, that's not reasonable. So I think part of this, as low as reasonably possible, my issue with it is exactly what you're saying, is if it's just a pencil whipping thing to say, hey, CYA, you know, we did what we were supposed to do. We thought about stuff and other things happened. That's too bad. Is that once you become aware of risks or issues, I think that's where that practical part changes. What are the actual consequences of failures here? And now we need to adjust and make improvements, especially when there's better technology out there and there's better ways to do this. There are technical ways to create window frames that just do not leak. They can accommodate the seasonal motion, the temperature variation caused motions, and stay remain sealed. So I get this argument or this idea that, well, we decide we're going to sell it for $2 less, so we can't possibly do what's technically possible. I'm like, well, that's not as safe as reasonably practical in my mind.
And another good example is the blowout preventer for the Deepwater Horizon. That was famously built to specifications. And there were a couple of issues with how it's manufactured, and then some wires were put the wrong way around. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, one of the, I think the blind shear ram, it was, had it functioned correctly, it would have saved the day.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it didn't function correctly was because of the drill string was pushed to the side through a well-known failure mechanism, which wasn't included in the standard against which the blowout preventer had to be built in accordance with.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reality is people can arbitrarily or retrospectively say something, oh, that thing that we thought was safe wasn't safe.
Right. Yeah, it's easy to do. It's easy to do after the fact.
But safe is there's no such thing as safe in terms of this objective, you know, forensically diagnosable state. It's something is safe if we say it's safe. If it's got a sticker on the side of it, it's safe, because that's safe is a concept which we have invented to say it is okay to be used in scenario XYZ.
So like if I buy a toaster and it has the UL sticker on it, Underwriters Laboratory says this is safe. What it's interpreted as. It doesn't mean I can stick my fork inside the toaster while it's powered up. That's
true. But it's also, if there is any sort of issue, or this framework through which you went to say something was safe or not safe, if that was flawed, as soon as that sticker's on the side of that toaster, it's safe. Yeah. It doesn't matter if you have the test didn't uncover the issue associated with that exposed lead or whatever it is that might create a situation we think or feel is fundamentally unsafe. As soon as there's a sticker on it, as soon as we've said, hey, it's been built in accordance with the standard, we're going to install it on the bottom of the ocean, we deem that thing safe, and that's all that matters. It's a designation.
So
I think as low as reasonably practicable is problematic, because it creates this ongoing internal dynamic where all we're trying to do is essentially ask ourselves, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And I know what your perspective is on sort of these compliance driven activities. Have we passed yet? It doesn't, as a rule, for me at least, result in fundamentally more reliable or safer systems. Those organizations where reliability and safety is just part of what they do, they almost don't care about the safety case, because they know it's safe. They know it's reliable. They know it's going to be safe and reliable, and it's going to pass whatever criteria you put up to say that something whatever criteria you come up with for something being reliable or safe.
Well, we talked about this idea of the warning signs and the culture. You were talking about Los Alamos and the near misses they've had over the years and different accidents they've had, and just this idea of, if the culture is actually paying attention to safety, internal to their factory, internal to their workforce, internal to how their products are created and manufactured and how they operate, then it's a never ending process of identifying risks and minimizing them, and balancing the functionality that you're delivering with it being done in a safe manner where it doesn't harm people or the environment and so on. Whereas others that are driving straight to a standard, there's just too much blue smoke and hand waving going on for it to be a rational approach.
And then you have to talk about what is reasonable. What's reasonable to you might not be reasonable to me, or what's reasonable to you in 2021 might not be reasonable to the same engineer in 1960 who designed that bridge.
That's right. And it might not be reasonable to the jury that's suing your company.
Right.
You know?
Yep. Might not be reasonable to the public. And that's a problem. You look at NASA, for example, the engineers in circa 1986 when the Challenger disaster happened, and circa 2003 when the Columbia disaster happened, they privately believed the reliability of the system was between 1 in 50, or had a failure probability, I should say, of between 1 in 50 and 1 in 100. But you speak to the managers and the bureaucrats and the program leaders and the people who are reporting directly to Congress and the president, they would publicly state that the failure probability is in the order of 1 in thousands.
Right.
So, and what part of the reason that was the case is because everyone knew that the public wouldn't accept a 1 in 50 to 1 in 100 failure probability. That's just too high. So what is reasonable is a very difficult question to answer.
Well, that makes for a good standard, doesn't it? I mean, on the face of it is, yeah, you got to reduce risk. It makes sense. And you would have no product if you reduced it to no risk whatsoever, because the only way to do that is not have that product or system available. Just don't have it. Then you have no risk from that failures from that system. I think that's the only way you could get to absolute zero risk.
Do nothing.
But even that is a risk, because now your medical device is not saving lives, for example.
Right.
And, you know, all the other things our products are supposed to do that make life, I would say better, but it's hard to say sometimes, especially if you help a friend move. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things to move. There's not a lot. The beer and pizza is a good compensation for moving, but it's probably not good for you in a risk reduction back pain type issue.
No.
I digress. But the idea is I think you're exactly right, is that part of it is what is reasonable. And I remember hearing that definition is we need to reduce the risk so that it's susceptible to the executives that go to jail if there's a failure.
True.
If they're okay with it, then we're okay with it. And I always had trouble with that, because the frontline folks, we knew exactly what the risk was. We could see it. We could see and manifest it and experience it and go, this isn't right. And said, it's get back to work, just ship it. Like, no, this isn't right. But we don't have the authority to stop the line, at least mm-hmm. in that organization I was in.
Well, plenty of good organizations do.
Yeah.
Very well-known ones sort of venerate the ability of anyone to push that button to stop the line.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that also encourages lots of second order benefits, where people identify precursors to bigger, badder things, and we are able to stop the line, fix that teeny tiny problem before it turns into a full blown multi-planet catastrophe. Right. So that's another podcast topic. I think we've covered that a few times, but it's funny how those organizations tend to do very well.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And it's funny to me, the safety standards and this as low as reasonably possible, practical, doesn't focus on those precursors. It focuses on final product out the door. It doesn't focus on material variability in my insulation on the electrical wiring. It says, do I have enough conductor, and do I have by design enough insulation on it? And does it pass the, various electrical tests? All right, it's safe. Well, really?
there's a place for that thought process you just talked through. There is a place for asking ourselves, do we have enough conducting material? Do we have enough this? But when that becomes when that devolves into a very simple process of us asking ourselves easy questions and answering them, providing even easier answers to make sure that we can ordain that process as being compliant or not, that's when bad behaviors tend to manifest themselves. The other thing you're missing too is things change. We often do safety cases or risk management activities or risk assessments at the very start of something.
Yeah, everything's fresh and new and clean and carefully built. Yeah.
But things change, and it's just sometimes hard for organizations to get those sometimes onerous risk assessments and risk management documents and rigorously interrogate them for ongoing validity as the processes get older over time.
Yeah. Well, one of the best examples I ran into where this manager, he was the operations, chief operations officer, I guess, is for this small company. He was constantly thinking about, you know, if we build 100 of these, do we get so lax that we could put a spanner across this? And it was a big battery pack, essentially, and a lot of energy into it. And so he was worried about that. And how do we keep our processes so that what is inherently, you know, not safe, we got the skins off of this, all the protections are disabled, and we need to do this wiring or this technique. How do we keep that from devolving into something that becomes people stop thinking about the risk? And I mean, it was just that kind of thought process. And he was like, is it possible to have arc flash? Do we have enough energy that it could cause a real, you know, big problem? One of my people get killed or seriously hurt. How do we avoid that? he didn't wait for any of these things to occur. He was constantly asking those kinds of questions about,
good on him,
you know, and it's, I think as a start of an organization, it's building a great culture of people that paid attention to stuff like that. And it got built into the system systematically that you pay attention to this stuff. And it wasn't as, you know, if it was unsafe to work the weekend to get this stuff done, he didn't do it. Even if he had a big shipment on Monday, he says, well, we'll delay it. We'll tell him that we're going to do this right. You know, he was
good. Yep.
I saw a note from those guys the other day. They're expanding and it looks like their little startup is getting another big round of funding and they're doing well. So I think part of it is that culture.
I was about to say, it's, again, isn't it amazing how organizations who take this seriously reap benefits and second order effects, which other organizations can't really see the link to safety and reliability.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I guess that's the takeaway, you know? So if you're listening to this, which kind of organization are you in? Is, you know, meet the standard and hope for your best and ignore problems as they occur, or more a culture that we've just described that actually pays attention to stuff and nips it in the bud, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So that just, there is inherently safe. Let us know. Mm-hmm. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. Let us know your thoughts or questions on this. And once again, shout out to Nick for sending us this idea, asking what our thoughts are on ALARP. I'm going to use that. It's easier for me to say. You know, if you got a question like that, or you want to get our opinion on something or share your opinion with us, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. You can also find Chris and I and the other hosts of the show on LinkedIn or on our About pages. And we certainly look forward to hearing from you. So, Chris, you got any like hang gliding today or other extreme sports of some sort?
No, just trying to get my kids to clean their room.
You're in big trouble now.
That's a much more dangerous than hang gliding. Take hang gliding any day over trying to get that to happen without incurring serious bodily harm.
Yeah, no, good luck with that. Yeah.
luck is all I've got.
There you go. All right, well, thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you later.
Cheers, Brad. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.